Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour, we'll be inviting you to call in here and talk about your feet. Ask foot care questions. You know, from time to time throughout the year, we have physicians on the program. Some of them are generalists. Some of them deal with specific parts of the body, and that's what we'll be doing here this morning. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's a doctor who specializes in dealing with the foot and the ankle. And if you have some problem and you'd like to talk a little bit about it, you can certainly call in and talk to him. And every time I have a doctor here on the show, I say the same thing. Now, do keep in mind that this is very difficult because the doctor can't see you. And it may be if you have a real problem, you need to pursue that with someone who can. But you're certainly welcome to call, ask questions. I know he can give you some basic information and maybe start you off. And then you might well have to take your feet to somebody who can take a look at them. But certainly, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being
here. You're welcome.
Once again, we have someone already ready to go. So let's do that in Champaign. And this is line one.
Hi.
Yes.
Thanks for being here. I'm a 45-year-old female, 6 foot tall, 250 pounds, and I started about 4 months ago to get into shape, and I began working with weights with a personal trainer and also a treadmill on my own. About 1 month after I started, I suddenly got this pain in my right heel, and then that's one concern. And the second concern was on my left foot over the tarsal bones, I get an ache there that resolves only about after 30 minutes on the treadmill, and then it's gone. But when I initially start the treadmill, it hurts. The right heel pain, you know, I got some gel pads for it, and I'm taking naproxen, 500 milligrams 2 times a day. What do you suggest?
Well, first thing is I'm not a real fan of the treadmill sometimes in terms of walking activities, things like that.
Oh, really?
Well, it's not that I don't like the treadmill. It's that usually the treadmills themselves can go ahead and bring on some problems with the feet because of the fact that the treadmills usually aren't perfectly level. Or when you're walking on the treadmill, you go through and with an incline and things like that. Around this area, it's very flat, so we walk always on level surfaces. And when you go ahead and work out on the treadmill, frequently you're at an incline.
I'm flat when I'm doing it.
But the thing is that the treadmill itself probably isn't flat.
Ah.
So a lot of times I'll have patients that will go ahead and start to walk on the treadmill, and they have problems with, usually the plantar fascia, where it becomes irritated with pain in the back or the bottom of the heel, or Achilles tendonitis because of pulling on the back of the heel. And it's related to the fact that they have some tightness in the ankle in the first place because of tight heel cord muscles, and that as a result of trying to walk kind of slightly uphill, they have to flatten their foot out to go ahead and be able to have the normal range of motion for mechanics of walking, and that puts strain on these particular structures.
Okay, I also put arch supports in.
That would even sometimes make it worse.
Would
because
it?
Now you've taken away your body's ability to compensate for the flattening out of the foot and then put more strain on some of the other structures. The tarsal pain can be related to that too, because now you're trying to fold your foot up in the area of the tarsal because you don't have the range of motion at the ankle. So what I usually tend to tell patients, if this is your treadmill at home, is go ahead and take an actual carpenter's level and put it on the treadmill itself and measure it to make sure it is level. So something, frequently it's not. I mean, you have to build up the back of the treadmill to make sure it is flat. And then hopefully as a result of doing that and using the supports and the shoes, you'll be able to not put the stress and strain on those particular structures.
So I should leave the arch supports in?
Yes, leave the arch supports in because that's going to help the plantar fascia, which has been irritated,
okay,
as well as the other. But now you have to stop trying to fight it. You put the arch support in, and you're on the treadmill that's slightly inclined, and then you're trying to push through the support. And so it's best to go ahead and elevate the whole thing.
Okay, and what about the tarsal pain over the left foot? What do you think?
Really, I think that's all related to it as well.
Is it? Okay.
Now, that could be, but also you could have some arthritic changes in those areas too. That's hard to say.
Okay. At what point do I stop doing what I'm doing and come in and see a podiatrist?
Well, I would go ahead and how much time are you spending on the treadmill?
I go for an hour about 4 times a week. And like I said, after 30 minutes, there's no more pain.
Well, that's usually how it goes, but then that's because the body can can go ahead and you know, release substances that can decrease the pain, but you're still having the problems with that particular area. So I would maybe go ahead and maybe back off on the amount of time that you're on the treadmill, and see if that helps. You know, a lot of times you have to go ahead and do some rest if you have a structure that's injured. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have to do anything. You could easily do some, you know, cross training in terms of recumbent bike, elliptical trainer, water aerobics, things like that, that don't go ahead and put pressure on those areas in the meantime.
Okay. So you give it a couple more months and then see somebody?
You should probably see some improvement in about 4 weeks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right,
thank you. Next caller is on the road here on I-74. Someone calling on a cell phone, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I have diabetes, and I have neuropathy in my feet. And I've been told that I should get some diabetic socks. And I really don't understand what the difference between a diabetic sock is and a regular sock, and I don't understand why they cost so much money. So can you maybe tell me about diabetic socks and why I should get them?
Well, the diabetic sock basically is something that is designed specifically as in the materials and also how the sock is sewn so as to provide the most protection and proper fit for the foot. So unlike tube socks that we see, they just really aren't made anymore as a sock for the foot. They're not sewn properly. So the diabetic sock, first off, is an actual sock that will hopefully fit the contours and shape of your foot. Because what you have to worry about is, because as you said, if you have some neuropathy, which is where the sensory nerves in the foot no longer recognize pressure, temperature differences, pain, etc. So you can have a ridge in the sock and fold up, and you can walk on that all day and have a blister that forms. So that's the reason why you would like a sock that goes ahead and is of the proper materials in terms of usually a cotton, mostly cotton blend, or sometimes there's a wool blend in there as well, to go ahead and help with absorption of moisture, as well as to cushion the foot and also fit properly.
And in fact, I didn't realize I had the neuropathy until, it's kind of graphic, but one day I stepped on a piece of glass and I didn't even notice it.
Sure.
So I looked behind me and I noticed I was leaving a bloody footprint. And
right.
I looked down and I went, what the heck?
That's usually how it goes.
I took a piece of glass in my foot, and I went, gee, I wonder how long that's been in there.
Very true, and that's why it's important for diabetic patients to look at their feet every day.
And that's what I've been, ever since that happened, I've been doing that, and I see a podiatrist regularly, and he's the one that told me to get the socks, but I thought I'd get somebody else's opinion.
Right. It's certainly worthwhile. You only have one pair of feet, and certainly it's worth the couple of bucks to go ahead and buy a good sock.
They're like $8 a pair, though.
Usually if you care for them properly, they're going to last you a lot longer than a pair that's $3.
Yeah, that's true. All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Urbana is next. This is line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a walking-related injury, I believe. I have been a walker, but I recently significantly increased my walking, and I noticed that in the forefoot area, particularly on my right foot in the metatarsal area, it seems to be very tender. I'm attributing that to having walked a little bit on an older pair of shoes. I've now got better shoes, and I've even got some cushioned inserts in there. But I'm still having this very tender area. Sometimes it even seems a little bit swollen. I wondered if you could suggest what this might be caused by and whether or not I need to see someone about this or what to do.
Well, how long have it had?
Wait.
Don't go away. The doctor wants to ask you some questions.
I'm still here. I was going to say I'd hang up and listen.
No. How long has the pain been?
This has probably been, 6 weeks or so now. I'm still walking.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to take it slow, not really push too hard, reduce my speed a little bit. And as I say, I've gotten a new better pair of shoes, and I've even gotten some extra cushioned inserts in there, and they have certainly helped.
Does the foot hurt only when you're walking, or how about at night when you're trying to go to bed? Does it ache or anything like that?
It does not hurt at night. It doesn't hurt when I'm sitting. It doesn't hurt all the time. Even if I'm walking around barefoot, it's not like it's a continuous pain, but I notice it in particular if I do movements to the feet where I bend my foot down, and then like if I'm squatting down, doing something on the floor, I'll notice that area is tender.
Well, what concerns me a little bit is because you said it's somewhat swollen in that particular spot over the metatarsals. Sometimes you can have, it sounds like what you start out with was just some what's called metatarsalgia or stress to the bones themselves, and they can ache some, but then you can, if you persist with the pressure on those particular areas and the stress on the bone, it can move into a possible stress fracture.
Okay.
So that's something that, because of the fact that it's been there for a long period of time, you'd have to think about that as a possibility. Usually stress fractures, though, they hurt off weight bearing, usually when you just get off your feet, and they tend to throb a little bit. But they can be very difficult to diagnose sometimes just for yourself, and when I see them, I just take one look at the foot, and you can usually tell if you're suspicious of that. And it really takes an X-ray to go ahead and to rule that out, especially if you've done all these other things, and which are good, but it hasn't resolved the problem.
Right. It certainly has improved.
Right, but it's still there.
But I can still tell that the area is a bit tender.
Yeah.
Particularly, it's closer to where the toes connect to the rest of the forefoot area.
Right. So sometimes it might be worthwhile to have somebody take a look at it just to make sure that there's no other problem brewing.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, right, thanks. Bye. Just for a second, let's talk about shoes. This time, first of all, you look and you see people wearing all kinds of stuff, but at this time of the year particularly, a lot of people are going to be wearing sandals. And some of those, I really wonder, are they really providing much, if any, kind of support for the foot? I know you can go out and you can buy hiking sandals, and they're probably going to be pretty good. But then you can also I see a lot of people wearing flip flops, and that's just a flat piece of rubber. That's not really going to do much of anything.
True. Yeah, the sandal it all revolves around the construction of the sandal.
Yeah.
If we have it.
I was just looking at my shoes.
If you can have some of the sandals with a nice contoured footbed that gives plenty of support to the foot, others that have the straps, buckles, etc., that go ahead and go around the back of the heel and the top of the foot to hold the foot securely inside the sandal. I think that's an important part, and certainly the flip flops don't really meet that criteria. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I still think that people are going to be paying for their indiscretions with their footwear in the future. But you really can't convince them of that.
All right. So, particularly as far as flip flops are concerned, your suggestion would be don't spend a lot of time in them.
I'm not a big flip flop fan.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're just not something as you said, they're just a piece of soft rubber. You can see people walking. You can take a look at the way the foot actually sits inside of it, and it's in a really bad position, and most of them are like that, where you could take a normal foot and have them walk in the flip-flop for a while, and you can give them symptoms. So it's it's best that you stay away from that. And again, it's something that if you can go ahead and utilize the sandal that holds the foot so you don't have to grip with the toes to go ahead and keep the sandal or flip-flop on, then fine. But most flip-flops aren't that designed.
So that just – well, actually, I happen to have on a pair of sandals right now that are not the kind that have the strap that goes around the back. And there are a lot of sandals like that you really do have to grip with your toes to keep it on.
Right. Right.
So you're kind of saying you might want to think about a different style.
I think so. As far as especially like we see a lot of patients who, let's say, wear Birkenstocks, and Birkenstocks are fine. But then they say, boy, I have these problems when I walk for exercise. I said, well, what are you walking in? Well, I'm walking in this sandal. Well, that's not designed for something like that. Hmm. So I think they're fine for you know, certain things, but not for, let's say, everyday activities.
Yeah, all right. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist at Carle Clinic in Urbana. We're talking about foot care, and if you have a foot question, he will do his best to give you an answer. Give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in St. Joe, and this is line one.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
I was a runner until my injury. I was up to about 20 miles a week. But I have on my second toe, it might be bursitis or something, but that joint is really painful, even with any pressure on there. And I was wondering, if it is bursitis, how can I tell, and what do I do to correct it?
Frequently, we have problems with pain and swelling underneath that second metatarsal head where the toe attaches to the rest of the foot. And it can be secondary to chronic repetitive stress on that particular structure on the bottom, which is called the flexor plate. And then sometimes we can have is because of the chronic inflammation, some degradation of some of the ligamentous structures in that particular area, or you can actually get a tear in the plate itself, which then causes just the chronic pain and swelling, but also sometimes some movement of the toe where the toe itself starts to drift. It can drift over the third toe, over the big toe. It can become a hammer toe deformity, things like that. So it all kind of depends on how long the problem has been there. We see it in patients who have a long second metatarsal or a situation where the first metatarsal is very flexible and what's called hypermobile and puts more stress on the second. So those are things that really, if it's been there for, let's say, a couple of months, it's something that really needs to be looked at to hopefully be able to go ahead and knock down the inflammation so we don't have any derangement of the soft tissue structures in that area, and then kind of get down to the why it's there in the first place.
Oh, I see. So I really need to have someone take a look at it.
It probably would be best.
Okay.
And you want to really prevent it.
Oh, pardon me.
You really want to prevent it from being in a situation where all of a sudden then the toe starts to drift.
Because
if the toe's drifting, then there's nothing to do for it besides surgery.
Oh, wow.
So...
okay. Well, and I should avoid those flippers, too, huh?
I would think so.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Do you find that is it natural over time that people develop the same kind of joint issues in their toes that you have other places that may reduce the flexibility of those joints? And does that affect the way that people walk if their toes don't want to flex properly?
Most of the time, in terms of digital deformities in feet, we see that, again, I always joke about the fact that can't wait to talk to the engineer who designed feet because I've got some questions. Because why did they design them like hands? Because they don't do the same things, and the toes are kind of the same in terms of the design. But what we're looking for in a toe is to go ahead and act as a rigid beam to go ahead and propel forward with and push off of. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it has all these joints in it, so to have that rigid beam, you have to go ahead and have these rather complicated mechanisms of ligaments, tendons, muscles that pull it with equal and opposite force to lock these joints up so that you go ahead and push off. Unfortunately, over time or other instances, you get a situation where you have a lack of muscle tendon balancing, so one group overrides another. So that's where you get these flexure contraction deformities, and all of a sudden as a result of that, and then we have weakness of the actual forces at the end of the toe, which propel you forward, and then if you have more weakness, then it snowballs, and so then you have digits then you get the hammer digit deformities, and you get the mallet toe deformities or claw toes, and so then these are very inefficient or how they function, and so then it puts more stress and strain on other areas of the foot, which then become uncomfortable as well. So those are the problems that we see usually as far as the foot's concerned. It's not necessarily change in range of motion of certain of those joints in terms of becoming stiff or anything else. The big toe joint is one that can go ahead and become stiff and inflexible. In the hands, most of the time also, you'll get situations where some of the arthritic changes that you see in the hands are a little different. So I said the function of those particular structures, the hands and feet are so different. And what happens to these other things that they tend to wear out? But I also say the engineer is going to tell me that, number one, we never designed the foot to go in a shoe.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, you never designed it to last that long. And that's the other thing. So it's something that will just wears out over time.
All right. Well, we have a number of callers here. We'll get back to people with questions. The next in line is in Urbana, and this is line two.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I had a bunionectomy about 3 years ago, and at the same time, hammer toe corrections of about three toes on that foot.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, I've had a pain in the ball of my foot, and it hasn't gone away over all these years. I'm a little reluctant to go back to the original podiatrist, and it wasn't you, by the way, because if he did something wrong, I don't know whether he would admit it or not. So I guess I'm sort of in a quandary as to what to do, and I guess what I guess one question of you is, can you think of any common malpractice or ordinary goof-up that would happen during a bunionectomy and or a hammer toe correction that would cause such pain?
Hmm. You know, it's one of those things. Most people are. I mean, you like to think everybody is an honest individual, and
right.
It's not that.
Well,
that,
I don't have any reason to distrust the guy. It's just that I see an obvious conflict of interest. Should that have been the case?
Well, but it's one of those things. Let me tell you this. I've actually retired from doing surgery now, so I can.
Okay.
So it's one of those things that's always difficult to do some of the lesser digit surgery. You know, the lesser toes are the ones that always give you trouble.
Right.
Give me a bunion any day, and you can really predictable results in terms of how to fix that and everything else. It's the other ones that are a difficult matter. I don't think that in those situations it's anything that revolves around malpractice, which means that somebody made a terrible mistake that obviously shouldn't have been done. It's more of a situation where we don't necessarily always understand exactly what is causing the problem with the positional abnormality of the toe, and then even if we do, what to do to fix it, and so that is really the factor. And sometimes you really only recognize that after it doesn't work. And so I would always recommend to patients is to go back to the person who did the work, mainly because they know what they did.
Okay.
You go to someone else, and like if you came in to see me, I'd look at it and say, well, geez, what was done to fix this? And you'd say, well, I don't know.
Yeah,
and
okay.
So it's always best to go back to the person who actually did the procedure, and they can look at it and say, oh, okay, I see what happened here.
Okay.
Then here's what we need to do to fix it.
Okay.
So, I would go that way.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and next is line three, callers in Newton. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 64 years old and very active, and my right foot seems like it's got some numbing in it, and I just wondered if that was blood circulation was not as good as it used to be or what.
Well, we hear this particular problem a lot as far as patients complain about numbness in a foot, both feet or toe, et cetera. When you have numbness, it's usually never circulation. It's always nerve-related. So then you have to try to figure out, just like an electrician does in the house, if you've got a bad circuit somewhere, trying to figure out where the source of that numbness may be is based on the distribution of the nerves that go to that particular part. And so when I have a patient that says that they have the numbness, I have to tell them or ask them exactly where the numbness is. So is it just the one part of the toe? Is it two toes? Is it the top of the foot, bottom of the foot?
It's all across the toes and right behind.
Is that include the top of the toes and the bottom of the toes?
More so underneath, I feel, make my toes go down.
Yeah, because the distribution is what tells you what the problem or where the problem's at. And a lot of times when there's that kind of numbness in the foot, it's not the foot where the source of the problem is.
It's, could be
it's,
above.
It's above it. And usually it's always that particular situation unless it's a particular major trunk of nerve that goes to the forefoot.
That might explain then every couple hours, a lot of nights I wake up with a hurting in my leg and I got to get up and stand on it for a few minutes and I can lay back down and it's all right for another couple hours.
Right. Because the thing is the nerves that go to the feet are from the lower back. And the lower lumbar region is frequently a source of degenerative disc disease and pinching on those particular nerves. So a lot of times we get patients who complain about foot pain and numbness, and it's really from those other sources that's causing that problem.
What is best to be done for that then?
Well, first step is probably primary care doctor and have them go ahead and look at it, or You can have a podiatrist take a look at it and kind of see specifically where that numbness is. And then we usually either, if we have some suspicion of nerve entrapment somewhere or other problems, send it to the neurologist where they go ahead and try to pin down where that particular problem may be. As I said, it's kind of like an electrician trying to figure out why you have a short circuit in some areas or something. So you need them to come out and do some testing.
Right.
Okay.
Okie dokie. Thank you. This is a very interesting program.
Well, thanks for the call. Yes, we'll keep on going. Next is someone in Paris, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Paris, Illinois here. I'm 81 years old, type 2 diabetic. Had my second toe on the right foot amputated because of a MRSA infection from hammer toe trouble. My podiatrist is a good one. I got complete faith in him, and he wanted to do a hammer toe job on me. But I chickened out because I'm afraid of this MRSA infection getting in there again.
Mm-hmm.
And is that really the best answer to hammer toes, is surgery?
Well, certainly in situations where, let's say, a diabetic patient like yourself has had previous problems, prevention is the one of the best things. If you have a substantial hammer toe deformity that can't be accommodated with shoes, et cetera, and your circulation is good and your blood sugar is under good control, there's no reason why you can't consider doing that, because that will actually decrease your risk of ulceration and amputation if you remove the deformity. So as long as everything else is in good shape, that would be a reasonable thing to consider.
Oh, that's very nice to hear. I'm bicycling on a stationary bike instead of walking to take
good.
The pressure off those toes.
That's a good idea.
So that's my only exercise anymore, but it's boring as hell.
Well, I know, unfortunately.
I turn on the Travel Channel and go all over Italy.
That's the best way to do it.
Yeah, thanks for your help.
You're welcome.
Right. Bye.
We are about midway through here again. Our guest for this hour, Focus 580, is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist. He's a doctor who specializes in the foot, and he works over at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And if you have questions, give us a call. I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and we will keep on going here. The next caller is in Champaign, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I am a fairly new runner, and I don't want to give up running. I'll say that right from the beginning. And I have, as you look down on my feet on the right, right about the middle, there's some swelling and a little bit of pain above. I have had a physical therapist look at it, and he said he couldn't find any broken metacarpals or anything was broken. Probably it was a swollen ligament. I pretty much tried everything that I was supposed to, the ibuprofen for 3 days, frozen peas on it 15 minutes after, and I have been doing a little bit of cross training, but I really, because I'm kind of sort of starting this running late in life, don't want to stop it. So I'm wondering if there's any sort of an orthopede or any kind of a thing I can get to place there to help with that. It doesn't hurt when I'm running, just when I stop.
So how long has it been giving you a problem?
I would say 3 weeks.
3 weeks, huh?
Yeah. And it does, a couple of times I've taken like 5 or 6 days off
mm-hmm.
of running, and then it does get better. And then when I run again, it does, it sort of swells up and you can feel it hurt after I stop running.
Now when you say, where's the swelling at?
The swelling is, as you're looking down at your foot, uh-huh. it's just more towards the heel than the middle, and about 3/4 of the way up the foot.
Okay, this is kind of difficult. I can't really tell exactly what would be the source of the problem. You know, certainly sounds more like more of a tendonitis, something like that, than anything else. Possibly a tendonitis in some of the.
Okay.
Now, is it more toward the inside of the foot than the outside?
It's the outside.
It's more the outside.
Oh, I'm sorry. More towards the inside. Oh,
okay.
More towards the inside of the foot.
Okay. How close is it toward the ankle?
It's probably directly below the ankle.
Yeah, it sounds like it might be some tendonitis, and because the tendon sheaths in those particular areas can get pretty irritated, and they can swell quite a bit too. That would be one that you'd have to have somebody look at. That would be trying to figure out exactly what the source of the problem. It could be something very simple as some overuse, and it should go ahead and calm down with some rest. The problem with running, you have to realize that it's great to be zealous in regards to wanting to go ahead and continue with it. But if you want to go ahead and continue with it successfully, you have to realize that if there is an overuse problem, that you do have to back off and rest. Because
the elliptic machine, I can simulate the running feeling using an elliptic machine. And
okay.
It doesn't hurt after using okay. that. So would you say then that the elliptic machine is probably a pretty good idea?
Yes, I would say if that was the case and you are not having the symptoms by doing that, I would switch to that at this point.
And, all right, well, thank you. Oh, okay.
And just making sure that hopefully that's not going to flare things up.
Well, should I notice, is there anything that I should look for that might indicate that, well, you know, probably ought to have this looked at to make sure it doesn't need an operation or anything?
Well, I think just time. You know, if it persists for another 3 weeks, then usually a 6 week period of time is where these muscle tendon type of things should go ahead and resolve. And if it goes past that, somebody needs to see it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And next is line number two. This is a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
I wonder if you have any good advice about getting rid of this yellow toenail fungus infection other than Lamisil, which is terribly expensive.
Well, unfortunately, no.
No, huh?
Well, that's the problem. The fungus infection is a infection of the nail bed, and the fungus is something that's it's difficult to treat. Even the Lamisil is only about 50 to 55% successful at getting rid of it.
Uh-huh.
And yes, it's very expensive, and there's no real good cure for it. And there's more than one nail involved, or just one, or
well, right now it's my big toe on my right foot. The fungus seems to love that toe.
Yeah, usually we see it on big toes, little toes, or second toes, ones that have a more trauma to them, and that's one of the factors that tends to go ahead and cause the fungus to go to those particular spots.
What did you mean about traumatism?
No, trauma to the toe in terms of just irritation to it. The big toe is on, and the little toe are on the outside of the foot. They're going to get bumped. They're going to get stepped on. So it's just injuries to those particular structures that tend to then allow the fungus to start to grow.
So it's pretty hopeless, huh?
Well, and also the thing is, my thing is that and how much should we go to treating it? Because it really mostly is a cosmetic problem more than anything else.
Terrible.
I know, but
ugly.
You know, how far do we go to try to treat it,
yeah.
And is the treatment worse than the disease?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my take on it, and I know some people disagree. They say, oh, my God, it's an infection. You have to treat the infection, but, you know, that has to do with the virulence of the organism. So you can have the fungus there and live with it without any significant problems, but certainly sometimes taking medicine, doing a lot of other things can go ahead and as I said, cause more problems than the fungus in the first place.
Okay. Well, I'm disappointed, but thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Well, as you say, the problem with this medicine is, well, first of all, it doesn't always work. Secondly, it's very expensive. Third, it's systemic, so
right.
It goes through all your body.
You know, it's a safe medicine to take, but you do have to monitor liver function and everything else. Yeah. So
if you have, say you have somebody who has this problem, and say you just have it in one toe, and what you say is, well, okay, maybe I can live with that, but I don't want it to spread. Is there anything that you either should do or shouldn't do to try to at least prevent it from going from one toe to another one?
True. You can try. And let's say if you have a general fungus infection of the skin on both feet, you could utilize a topical antifungal medication on those areas and get rid of that. But and then let's say make sure that you only use a nail clipper on the affected nail, and you don't go ahead and use that on the other, so that you don't go ahead and actually – you know, kind of spread and inoculate the other spots, even though that it's there anyway. You know, it's all over the place. So.
And the fungus is it generally one of those things that's like the fungus is just out there everywhere in the world, and
right.
You just happen to have been unlucky enough to
Sometimes I think that also I'm suspicious that we might find out in the future that if we are able to go to the gene mapping store and go ahead and leave a copy of your DNA there and then come back later for the printout, that you'll see in these patients that have these chronic nail infections that there's actually an error in the coding for recognition of the fungus as being a foreign invader. Because mm-hmm. we have problems, one of the problems with the oral antifungals is reoccurrence. You go ahead and be fine. They take the medications, they get rid of the fungus, and then we get a repeat a recurrence of the fungus infection in 12 to 18 months. So it's one of those things where they don't seem to have any natural immunity to it, and they just have reoccurrence. So I think those are factors as well. But then I still don't understand why you can have one patient with five toenails and one foot that has total problems with fungus, and they've had that for 30 years, and the other foot's perfectly fine. I never understand that. But
okay. We'll keep going here and talk next with someone in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I would like to thank you so much for having this kind of informational program and for having Dr. Bourne, who's just highly informative and really, in my experience, very, very trustworthy and gives a lot of excellent information. That's just a little bit of an aside. I would like to ask if there's any way to limit the growth of a bunion, what kinds of factors actually influence the growth of a developing bunion, and what can be done to maybe limit that development?
Frequently, the bunion deformity is there as a result of we talked about muscle tendon imbalance before, and I think that it's still a big factor in this particular case. And a lot of times we see the fact that the foot itself has a problem as far as flattening out too much or pronating too much. And that causes instability in all those particular structures and then causes a drift of the big toe. And the big toe drifts one way, and especially the metatarsal, the first metatarsal drifts the other toward the midline of the body. And that's really what we see as a bunion. People think of the bunion as being a bone growth or things like that, but it's not. It's actually a movement and a migration of that first metatarsal. So it's important if someone has that particular problem is to go ahead and control the flattening out of the foot to try to provide stability so that you can at least try to prevent the bunion from getting any worse. Certainly it's great if you can treat it very early in that particular way and as in terms of trying to prevent it from developing in the first place or getting worse than it actually is.
So what you're saying is even surgery is unlikely to alter that except temporarily.
Well, no, because it depends on what surgery is done. Frequently, the surgery that's done will go ahead and address some of these biomechanical abnormalities or structural abnormalities of the foot. If somebody has a hypermobile first metatarsal where it just is not very stable, the surgery that's done is to go ahead and fuse some of these joints to provide the stability of that medial column of the foot so that it will go ahead and be in a more stable position when you push off of it as you walk. So now you can go ahead and actually achieve that with the surgery. But even frequently, even after the bunion surgery, I was always a big believer of trying to control the pronatory deformity of the foot with a support in the shoe, et cetera, to see if we can maintain stability and then prevent the bunion from reoccurring.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. And let's see. Next, we'll talk with a listener in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about a callus on the big toe. It's sort of a recurrent kind of thick callus. And I know some people control it by filing, but it's pretty large. Is there a recommendation that you may have?
When we see calluses, we always try to do a couple things. Number one, see if it's a callus or not. Is it a callus, which is just the body's normal response to abnormal pressure over a small surface area, and it becomes thickened as a result of that? Or is it a skin lesion? Is it something I've seen plantar's warts that look like a callus, but they're not a callus, or some other thing? So let's assume that it is a callus from pressure. So now they have to figure out why the pressure is there. So if you have it on the big toe, there's some particular reason why that toe is not working properly to go ahead and move upward as you go ahead and push off your foot. So then you have to find out why that's doing that. And so just going ahead and trimming it down certainly can make it more comfortable, but the real goal is to see why it's there and then address that particular problem. So
actually, it causes no discomfort whatsoever. It's mostly an aesthetic problem, I believe. My father said that at one point he has a similar problem, and he saw an endocrinologist and who had a a student in the office, and the endocrinologist pointed out my father's foot to the student, and mentioned something. So, is there other internal things? And I also don't feel that there is much pressure. It's straight to the side of the toe.
Well, right. It can, and there can be what's called a shear force callus too, where the shearing of the skin as a rotational problem of the toe can go ahead and the skin responds to shear force by forming callus as well, so it doesn't have to be directly underneath. So really, it's true. If it's asymptomatic and it doesn't bother you any and it's just something that builds up, and if you would want to go ahead and just file it down, that's fine, but you got to remember that to really try to limit friction on these areas where you file. So the skin responds to friction by increasing callus formation as well. So when you're using the file or a pumice stone or anything like that, I have patients use it underwater. So let's say at the end of a shower, you go ahead and in the stream of water, you go ahead and use that apparatus to go ahead and actually help lubricate the cutting edges of the file, clean those cutting edges, have the area soften and decrease the friction so it can work a little bit better and not stimulate more callus formation. So that'd be fine as well.
Okay. I also had another question. There was a caller with previous caller had a fungus problem. Although I'm skeptical myself, but I have an example of my brother who, after taking Lamisil and having only partial success, had some doctor develop a topical, which required a lot of discipline in filing down the toes, I guess, to let it penetrate to the nail bed, and applying the topical weekly over maybe 9 months or so, and pretty much he's pretty much clear.
Mm-hmm.
No,
there's a lot of those. If you go ahead and you take take 5,000 patients over, and let's say 5,000 patients with 30,000 toes, and it usually doesn't, in terms of the large studies, most of the topicals aren't really all that effective. But certainly in some cases, in some isolated cases, they are. There's a lot of different topical preparations that are used in trying to use things like DMSO as a vehicle to go ahead and allow penetration into the skin of a variety of the antifungals out there. And there's all sorts of the concoctions and preparations. And, as I said, some work, some don't, and patients have success. I don't argue with that, but usually if you do a double-blind study in these particular cases over a large sample, it's been found that they're not all that successful.
Could it be a problem essentially developing a standardized topical if, for instance, some preparations, if it requires a search, so to say, some preparations work on some patients, or so to say that they have to be customized, so then there wouldn't be a...
Well, it certainly would be possible. It would be pretty tough to design a study to do that.
I see.
So
perhaps even if there is an effective way, because of the nature of customization of that medicine, at this point there isn't really a mechanism to have a good study about it, right?
I would agree.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, it's. I guess my understanding too is that the issue here is that the nail is actually a tough material and you can't. It's difficult to what you'd like to do. It'd be able to do is just paint something on the top of the nail and have it go through it, be absorbed into the bed. But apparently, it doesn't work that way. Is that
well? Also,
is that,
also fungi right? is tough to get rid of. I mean, fungus is. It's just the nature of the organism. Yeah, you see it on your lawn. You see it on golf courses where they have terrible problems with fungus on some of the greens, and you. I don't know if you've ever seen how they then have to treat it. These guys look like they have hazmat suits and and my God, you know, how can you allow me to play on this green? And when you just had the guy out here, and of course, yeah, sure, go ahead. But it's very toxic material. Uh-huh. It's easy to kill the fungus, but unfortunately, it kills you at the same time. Uh-huh. You know, so that's another factor.
Well, and I guess too, then you're, if provided you're wearing shoes and socks, it's the perfect environment for fungus.
Nice environment for growing.
Yeah,
yes,
it's nice and warm and moist. Perfect. And fungus loves it. All right. Let's see. Where are we going here? Next, LaSalle County. How about that one? Line number four.
That sounds good.
Yes. Hi.
Hello. Hopefully you can tell me a few things I don't know already about this. I've been told that I have neuropathy, and it would be a lot worse if I had diabetes, which I don't have. I'm wondering, when I have these jumping nerves in any particular time, you know, or can I do anything about that? Or what about like soaking my feet in cold or hot water? Anything, would that do any good? And I can only lift my feet very slightly off the floor. That's the diagnosis I give you. I hope I can be helped.
It sounds like you might have, as far as no one ever had a source of a cause for the neuropathy?
No, except I met a doctor on the stairway at the hospital one time, and he said his wife had been up to Mayo's, and they had told her that it came through her father.
Yeah, unfortunately, as far as peripheral neuropathy is concerned, there's a lot of different causes for it, a lot of diseases that can cause it, but there's a big group that's called idiopathic peripheral neuropathy, where there's really no cause or no known cause for it. You just have the problem of the sensory nerves, where they just don't.
Well, they also said it was old age.
Well, that too. I mean, that's the.
And I'm 76.
Well, but not every 76-year-old has the severity of the neuropathy. Though I agree that we probably do have some decrease in sensitivity as we do get older. But it's a difficult problem. And in terms of doing anything as far as your feet are concerned, if you have a significant loss of sensation, then you just have to do.
No, I don't have that. I can feel everything.
Okay. So you have good sensation in your feet, but you just muscle weakness?
That must be it, okay. Maybe in the head.
And maybe, you know, in that particular case, I wouldn't really call it a sensory peripheral neuropathy then. Because usually if you have that particular problem, then you're going to have some significant alteration in your tactile sensation, or you can keep your tactile sensation, but then you lose other things. Again, the sensation of being able to distinguish hot and cold, vibratory sense, things like that. Uh-huh. You can lose those in particular and position sense, but you can still have sensation. There's a lot of strange combinations to peripheral neuropathy.
Yeah, I would say that I did, in probably midlife or so, I did have a bunion operation, and never seemed to bother me, although they did tell me that he left in a screw or something that mm-hmm. he would take out later if I needed, but I never seemed to have that problem. But you don't think, like, soaking it in water or anything like that, that would have any...
Probably not, but if it makes it feel better, that's fine.
No, I can keep my feet. Oh, I haven't been in a bathtub in so long it'd scare you because I'm afraid, you know, I'm getting in. But right. I wash completely otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We'll try to see if we can get at least one more call here. Champagne, line three. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had some knee pain and went to my chiropractor, and he indicated that I oversupinate, which means I walk bow-legged or on the outside of my feet. And apparently that's really unusual because the whole entire shoe industry is geared towards compensating for people who overpronate, which is people who walk with their knees moving towards each other or mm-hmm. something. And I've had no luck trying to find any shoe designed for someone who oversupinates, if I'm getting that terminology correct.
They're out there. I mean, there's plenty of people who, like yourself, who are supinators.
Well, I've been to Body and Soul.
They can't find anything.
Well, New Balance has something that's kind of neutral that stabilizes the inside and the outside, but 90% of their line moves your knees away from each other and
True.
Builds up the arch.
True.
And, yeah, I've been to most of the stores that I would guess would have shoes that have any orthopedic quality to them at all.
Mm-hmm.
They don't admit they're drawing a blank, but they don't really have anything that suggests that it's a compensatory shoe for oversupinators?
Oversupinators. Usually, you know, what you're looking for in that particular type of shoe also is a shoe that's neutral and has some decent shock absorption would be the biggest thing.
Yeah.
How much do you weigh?
I weigh 180.
So that's not too bad. You know, that's the big thing is trying to go ahead and because the foot in that position is not a very good shock absorber. So you get all that force that goes right up through your knee, which is a problem in the first place. Then it goes all the way up into your hip.
Uh-huh.
So that's what you would look for. Something that has is a fairly neutral shoe with a decent shock absorption. Problem is that you're going to run through shoes pretty quickly because of the fact that they'll collapse, and because of the shock absorption capabilities, they're not as durable or stable. And so then you're going to be running shoes every, you know, who knows how many miles, depends on how much you run. But that's the price you have to pay.
Yeah.
Because
I did pick a pair of neutral, like New Balance 926, fairly neutral, but, you know, standard inner-outer support shoes. And I'm kind of thinking maybe I need something a little bit more, but maybe I'll have to go to an insert.
Boy, I don't know about that. 926 is a pretty, it's pretty firm, though. You know, it's a stable shoe, but I don't know. As far as that guy with, qualities that you're going to be looking for if you oversupinate.
Yeah, well, see, that's what I ran into is all the shoe salesmen don't seem to have any recommendation for a person with.
Uh-huh. Well, that's something, you know, it'd probably be worthwhile to go onto the net and do some research yourself.
Okay.
In regards to looking and seeing, there's, you know, how there's plenty of forums, et cetera, looking for people, what their experiences are with supinators and seeing what shoes work out well.
Okay.
And that's, again, you have to be careful with weight, because that's the, you know, somebody who's real heavy that's a supinator, boy, that's a tough problem.
Combo, huh?
Yeah.
I appreciate your time.
All right, thank you. Well, we're going to have to go here. Just sort of as one last thought, I was always looking for things to talk about and came across a site with some general information about feet and what it said. Two things it says here. One is that 3 out of 4 Americans experience serious foot problems in their lifetime, but only a small percentage of the population is born with foot problems. Okay, so that's got to mean that something we're doing is causing problems. Generally speaking, what would you – are there some general things you could say about things that you can do to try and minimize the possibility of having foot problems?
Well, I think, again, unfortunately – We do have to wear shoes because we, again, walk on these hard engineered level surfaces and I think we abuse our feet a lot in terms of trying to or not taking into account the shape of the foot, the requirements that we have to go ahead and cover the foot and have it function properly with the footwear that we use. I'm a big fan of, again, tie shoe, so that you don't have to go ahead and grip with your toes. So, and then a shoe that amazing idea is that one that resembles the foot. So you're not trying to fit a square peg in a round hole all the time. And so that allows the foot to function properly, allows the toes to work well. And I think that's probably the best thing for it.
All right. Dr. Robert Bourne, he's a podiatrist at Carl Klink. Thank you.
You're welcome.